This time on your weekly Constitutional.
Edmund Randolph, the first Attorney General of the United States, says that, well, what happens if a president is found to be accepting foreign emoluments under the clause? Impeachment is the remedy.
That was Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, who thinks that our president has violated the Constitution. Others disagree. Here's Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law, Houston.
We don't think that the provision applies to the president, but even if it did, the sorts of transactions that are at issue, that's not what an emolument is.
But just what precisely is this thing called the Emoluments Clause? Or I should say, what are they? Because there are two of them, making it even more complicated to determine whether our president is violating them. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional. And this week, it's all about trumping the Emoluments Clauses.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
It's kind of hard to avoid our current president, isn't it? I mean, every time you watch the news, every time you're on the internet, he's there in one form or the other. And with all of the, shall we say, salacious and other allegations that are swirling around him, it's easy to forget that there are some very serious and somewhat difficult to understand legal, constitutional issues that are being litigated even as we speak. One of them that's very obscure, so obscure that it's not even taught in most constitutional law classes, is a controversy over something called the Emoluments Clause. Emoluments Clause. This sounds like something you rub on your hands, doesn't it? But in fact, it's a very important clause. And in fact, there are two of them in our Constitution. And broadly speaking, they prohibit somebody, perhaps the president, perhaps not, depending on whom you talk to, from accepting stuff, things of value, either from foreign entities or even from entities within the United States. We'll talk to two different people on two different sides of this issue. Eventually, we're going to hear from Josh Blackman. He's been on the show before, always does a great job. He's of the South Texas College of Law in Houston. And we'll also hear from Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, who thinks the president has indeed violated these clauses and perhaps, my goodness, should be impeached.
I'm Jed Sugarman, and I'm a professor of law at Fordham Law School.
Which is a remarkable thing, because in the last year, I think you're the fourth or fifth person from Fordham whom I've interviewed. You people are just fascinating.
And we learn a lot from each other, which is why these conversations begin and get into our expertise, which is a lot of fun here.
It is a lot of fun. I think I'm going to have to join your faculty. Then it'll be much easier to do these interviews in the future.
Join us.
Okay, thanks. Emoluments Clause, what the heck is that?
Great question, and it's a question people are asking more now than ever before, I assure you. Mm-hmm. There are actually two emoluments clauses. Mm-hmm. The first one is in the Constitution, relates to all federal officials, and it says that no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. So that's a broad clause trying to prevent foreign influence over federal officials.
In fact, and then there's a second. That's called the Foreign Emoluments Clause, typically, right?
We call that the Foreign Emoluments Clause.
Yeah. Okay.
And then there's another one called the Presidential Emoluments Clause, or the Domestic Emoluments Clause, which says that a president can't accept an emolument from the federal government or from the states.
So what is an emolument? It sounds
right.
It sounds like something you rub on your hands.
Exactly, and you know an emollient could be an emolument if it were a gift. Mm-hmm. One of my co-authors, I'm writing an amicus brief in the lawsuits, mm-hmm. and writing it with four other legal historians, and one of my co-authors dug into about 25 dictionaries from the 16th century up through the early 19th century. And the bottom line is that those dictionaries overwhelmingly explain that an emolument is some kind of benefit or reward. It is a very broadly understood word.
Okay.
Now, the Trump lawyers for the Department of Justice want to argue that the that an emolument is limited to an office-based salary, but that's inconsistent with not only all of those dictionaries in the research, but it's also inconsistent with how the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, use that word frequently in their own writing, and also the way that other legal scholars use that word very broadly to refer to benefits of, and profits of all kinds.
That's very important. I mean, to define our terminology. In fact, I was just talking to my introductory constitutional law class recently and talking about how very important it is to define how you're going to interpret the Constitution. And what we're talking about right now is something that's broadly called originalism, where you're trying to go back and figure out what the actual drafters of the Constitution meant. And sometimes, especially when it comes to these strange terms, it's extremely important to nail that down.
Yeah, absolutely right. And you can be an originalist or you can be an historian. You know, originalism is not the only reason why this is important. Mm-hmm. To understand what a word means, you have to understand both the text and the context. Mm-hmm. And so I would say anyone who's trying to interpret the Constitution, originalist or not, has to start with the text and context.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the way that we've framed our brief in this case.
And so an emolument, according to your research, is something very broad. It's any sort of benefit that the president or some other federal official might get. In fact, let's talk about that. You mentioned two different clauses. Do both of them apply to the president?
Great question, and this is one of the debates happening. So it's clear that the presidential or domestic emoluments clause only applies to the president. So mm-hmm. so it's unambiguous that the president is covered by that. And so federal and state emoluments could be, for example, when state officials or when the federal government provides benefit to President Trump, the exact what constitutes a problem. In terms of interpretation, we can get to later. There is a debate about whether the Foreign Emoluments Clause applies to the president. Mm-hmm. And let me say a word about that.
Please.
The phrase that creates a question about this is in the clause that I read before. No person holding any office or of profit or trust under the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that a plain reading of that, well, what does that mean, an office of profit or trust under the United States? That has always been interpreted as, when it comes up at different places in the Constitution, as a federal officer.
Okay.
Okay. Now, there
and that,
is.
And that would include the president because.
And that would include a president.
Okay.
So now there may be a question about whether a federal officer includes Congress people, senators or congressmen. But it's been pretty clear that a federal officer is anyone in the executive branch. So there is an argument, just to try and put it concisely, that in England before this period of time and beyond that in England, that the phrase office of profit or trust under the United States only refers to appointed officials. Because mm-hmm. in England, the executive branch is appointed, and the phrase was office under the crown. Mm-hmm. And so the interpretation here is that the Americans use this office under the crown and translated it to office under the United States with the similar way of making it only the officers under the chief executive. Mm-hmm. But this is, for a bunch of reasons, I think this is incorrect.
What are the reasons?
Well, first of all, we don't live in a monarchy, right? And I think the founding fathers also fought a revolution because they didn't want to live under a monarchy. So the phrase office under the crown is by itself its own phrasing for a monarchy, and it's not. And according to this interpretation, they substituted out crown and replaced it with president. But that's not what the phrase says. It says office under the United States. So it's implicit in this argument that the founders thought that the United States was interchangeable with the presidency, and that's a monarchic way of looking at the presidency, which is what the founders rejected. But furthermore, I think
before we get to furthermore, Jed, just let me comment that I recall that one of the reasons that James Madison was initially opposed to a Bill of Rights was the distinction between America and England. I mean, people said, we need a Bill of Rights. The English have a Bill of Rights. Why don't we have a Bill of Rights? And he said, because we don't have a king. I mean, you know, look at the first three words of the Constitution. It's us. It's we the people. And, you know, we're different. So I think that that's somewhat consistent with what you're saying from a different angle. But please, go on.
Absolutely right. And so that's a foundational problem. But I would say another problem is just putting just within the text of the Constitution, this interpretation simply doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So why would the founders have been so concerned with emoluments and people buying influence with the president that they would draft something called the Presidential Emoluments Clause to isolate the president as a particular concern for federal and state emoluments, but then draft another clause that covered everybody else but the president? That simply doesn't make sense as a matter of trying to understand the purposes of the Constitution.
I'm not taking sides here, but I'm going to interject something else that just occurred to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
There was such a concern about the president being influenced or being an advocate for foreign powers that in Article 2 they require, 14 years of continuous residency before someone can be the president of the United States?
Absolutely, that president must be over 35 years old, and they're less concerned, 30 for Senate and 25 for Congress. So they focus they put more emphasis on the president's residence and financial independence and age, put that as a higher burden on the president. So it would be bizarre to interpret the Foreign Emoluments Clause when foreign influence is a bigger problem than domestic influence, correct?
I kind of have to agree with you here, because everything I've read about that period tells me that the framers of the Constitution were extremely concerned about foreign influence.
Absolutely. And let me give you one more historical example of why. There was something called in the 17th century. It turns out that the great King Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, made a treaty called the Treaty of Dover with two kings in England, King Charles II and King James II, and it turns out that a century later, English historians discovered at the dawn of the American Revolution and just before they wrote the Constitution that there was a secret series of payments from Louis XIV to English kings that led to really disastrous wars, to wars that didn't go well between England and the Dutch. And the founding fathers referred to that deal, and they talked about the danger of a king buying influence with other kings. So they were particularly focused with chief executives getting bought out by foreign powers. That would apply primarily to presidents, they wouldn't exempt presidents. And finally, I think one other reason to mention is that the founding fathers actually said themselves that the Foreign Emoluments Clause applies to the president.
So there's legislative history there.
There's original ratifying history. There is the actual you could call it legislative history. We would call it, you know, the original intent here was that the Foreign Emoluments Clause would apply to a president, so much so that Edmund Randolph, the first Attorney General of the United States, says that, well, what happens if a president is found to be accepting foreign emoluments under the clause? Impeachment is the remedy. Edmund Randolph said that.
Attorney General of the United States.
And he said it to George Mason, considered one of the fathers of the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And the two of them are and no one in the Virginia Ratifying Convention said, oh, wait a second. I think you misunderstand something. So the big picture here in terms of constitutional interpretation is that we now emphasize something called original public meaning. So, but whether what did the public understand the Constitution to mean? Mm-hmm. And so just looking at the text, the plain meaning to a general reader would be that this applies to any federal officer. We look at Randolph and Mason, and their original intent was to apply to the president. And this is also the original public meaning. The argument that it doesn't apply to the president doesn't seem to fit any constitutional theory that people follow in the 21st century.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're speaking with two guys about the emoluments clauses of the Constitution and whether our current president is violating them. Later on, we'll hear from Josh Blackman of South Texas College of Law, but right now we're speaking with Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, and Jed's got more to say, so stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our conversation with Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, who's telling us why he thinks our president has violated something called the Emoluments Clauses. not everyone agrees with him.
I think that one of the people on the opposite side of debate, this debate, a fellow named Blackman, Josh Blackman, whom we're also going to talk to this episode, I think he argues that the president was exempt because elected officials have to face the voters. And therefore, the remedy for a president taking an emolument from a foreign source is not impeachment, as Edmund Randolph said to George Mason, but rather simply will turn him out at the next opportunity.
So a couple questions about that. I mean, first of all, if one wanted that to be the sole remedy for anything in the Constitution, then the entire Constitution becomes non-justiciable, right? Then the Constitution just becomes hortatory. We're going to put a bunch of guidelines and expectations in the Constitution, and there's going to be no way to go to court to enforce any of it because all of it will simply be worked out politically. And that would mean that the entire Constitution just becomes some aphorisms or you know, hopes and advice to the electorate. And that's not constitutional law, right? Mm-hmm. Law is rules that we turn to courts. And we put these constitutions in writing and to be enforceable by courts for the purpose of making sure that our original commitments in the founding are a law and bind our officials, right? Otherwise, we're no longer talking about constitutional law in a traditional sense.
Or as your law professor types like to say, the Constitution is regulatory as opposed to hortatory, like something like the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address. Those
exactly.
They contain fine sentiments, and it's perfectly fine for us to look at them and be guided by them and talk about them and maybe even to cite them in briefs occasionally, but ultimately they're not law, whereas the Constitution is law and it must be followed.
Right. That's exactly right. And let me say a word about that, about, you know, what the remedy is here, because, you know, these lawsuits on emoluments clause issues, they're, you know, these plaintiffs are not calling for impeachment. They're also not calling for, drastic or draconian remedies. They're simply asking for more information. Right? Part of the problem here is that Trump, with this organization, is making it non-transparent and unclear about how much money he's getting from foreign or domestic sources. So first, they're simply asking for discovery. And after discovery, they're simply asking for sequestering, either some way of avoiding or sequestering and setting aside any of these impermissible emoluments. So this is not about shutting down the Trump organization. It's simply about trying to get some basic enforcement of sequestering money from foreign sources.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. Let's talk about the precise allegations of these groups. And by the way, my understanding is that there are three distinct lawsuits that are pending. One of them was recently dismissed on not on the merits, but on the issues of standing and justiciability. Right. And that, I understand, is going to be appealed to the Second Circuit. So there's not really been any specific holding on these issues that we've been discussing. Two others, however, are pending, one in the district and one in Maryland. And your contention – well, let's talk about exactly what are the contentions of the people who are bringing these lawsuits. What has Trump done wrong? Specifically,
yeah, great question. So there are a couple of problems that have come up specifically in terms of the Foreign Emoluments Clause. The Trump Organization. Keep in mind, first of all, there's this big issue that the Trump Organization has. Trump claims that he's put it into a trust, and so there's a separation between the president and the Trump Organization. The problem is that trust is Trump is the sole beneficiary of the trust. It is revocable at any time. He can revoke the trust whenever he wants, even while he's president. And he can take profits from the trust at any time. And moreover, it seems pretty clear that there's not a real separation between the Trump and his sons who have been assigned to run the trust. There's surely overlap. The right way to have done this was to go about a process of separating and putting in a blind trust these assets. With the power of the presidency, with great power comes great responsibility. And if one signs up to be president, it comes with some expectations. So the problem that comes up.
But before we go on, Jeff, we've mentioned this term blind trust, and that's thrown around frequently. My understanding is that in the past, presidents who are often wealthy men, no women yet, but maybe eventually, wealthy men. Have investments. They're yes. Typically not major business owners like Trump is. But they have investments, and those investments are often in the forms of equity stocks, and so they'll have ownership in certain companies or partnerships or whatever, and obviously those companies and partnerships can be hurt or helped by various government policies. And so what they do is they take all their assets, they give them to a trustee, and they say, okay, trustee, do with them what you will. I mean, you can buy them, you can sell them. I don't want to know what's going on here, so I won't know if I own 1,500 shares of AT&T or 1,500 shares of Microsoft. Therefore, when I make a decision, it won't be affected by any concern I have about what it's going to do to my assets. And so my assets might go up, they might go down. I have no idea. And this separation, this blindness, then means that I don't have a conflict of interest when I make a decision on behalf of the American people. That's a blind trust, right?
That's exactly right. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so somebody else is managing it. But the thing is here that even if it's in a trust, it's nothing's been divested. It's still the Trump Organization, which I understand from news accounts, largely sells the name Trump and plasters it on other investments and then receives a fee for it. So in other words, this is all very, very public. So even if the president never spoke once to his sons, which, as you point out, seems somewhat unrealistic, he would know what the Trump Organization is doing.
Right. So in this case, I would say there's the right thing to do. It was not necessarily legally required, mm-hmm. but the right thing to do would have been to divest. The right thing to do would have been, given that the power of the presidency and the concerns about conflicts of interest with particularly this kind of business structure, the proper thing to do would have been to divest.
Well, Jed, but I have to play devil's advocate now, okay?
Sure.
His whole business model is himself.
Right.
It's his personality. It's his name. Is it possible for such a person to divest? Without destroying the business.
Well, let me give you an example. First of all, you know, there's a lot of concrete and mortar that have tremendous value, and someone could keep the name, and you know, even if it's, you know, there's all kinds of branding out there, he would sell off naming rights, and so yes, it's you wouldn't have it be owned by the president, but it would be the organization that carries on the name. That would be different without having the financial problem. But let me put it this way: Hank Paulson, when he became Treasury Secretary under Bush, basically put his assets into a blind trust and took a hit of something like $100 million, maybe $200 million, because he thought it was more important for him to play a public role and not have questions about his decision making. So he was willing to sacrifice something like $100, $200 million of value because he was interested in public service. So you're absolutely right. Trump might have taken a hit as big as that. But that is the choice that someone makes when someone shifts from being a free businessman, welcome to maximize profits, and then to shift into the presidency. What we don't want is someone who uses the presidency to enrich himself. And
not to trivialize this discussion, Jeb, but it sounds like Hank Paulson needs to pick better trustees.
No, but that's part of the problem, is one goes into the process knowing that selling, that converting something into a blind trust will take a hit. It's not simply expect. It was actually day one. It was not that the people who ran the trust ran him into the ground. It was that this kind of transition by putting things into a blind trust is a tremendous transaction cost, and one will take a hit at different points of the market. And that's just the cost. That's the cost of doing business, so to speak. That's the cost of when one wants to gain tremendous power. Tremendous power comes with tremendous responsibility.
I just heard an interview this morning, and we're speaking now in January, January 16th of 2018, on NPR, and it was the last two ethics chiefs, one from George W. Bush's organization and one from Obama's organization, and they were talking about this presidency, this first year of this presidency. Their claim was that it was the least ethical presidency or the most unethical presidency in the history of the presidency. And they were saying that even though perhaps Trump has not violated a criminal statute, that he's violated all sorts of norms and all sorts of good ethical ideas. And I'm hearing the same thing from you now.
Well, I would say more than that. I would say that we actually do have pretty concrete evidence that he has violated a criminal statute.
Oh, really? Please go on.
Well, It's the obstruction of justice statutes.
Oh, okay. I was talking about specifically ethical statutes, but okay.
Oh, that's correct. That I agree with. Although, you know, obstruction of justice is an ethical principle.
Yes, it is.
Right. And one can obstruct justice even when one has not committed a crime, but obstruct, or we can't know if one's, but separating that, those levels of questions, I understand the point you're making there, and that's true. Although I will say the reason why Congress in the 1960s and 70s, when it passed its ethics laws, they intentionally did not subject the president and vice president to those ethics laws because they decided there was a trade-off. First of all, they believed that the media and the scrutiny of a president was so much greater than other officials that the norms would be enforced more informally, and they were worried about passing statutes that could then be used to harass a president. So there was in a different context with a different set of presidents in our past, Congress was more willing to look at those trade-offs and exempted presidents from these conflicts of interest statutes. But we've never seen a president quite like this, and those trade-offs look different now.
In general speaking, there's a big question as to whether one can even criminally prosecute a sitting president.
Right.
I mean, there's a general presumption that if a president, any president, not just this one, has gone awry, that the remedy is impeachment. And though certainly someone might be prosecuted later criminally,
yeah,
for something done as president, and that was certainly a threat in the Nixon circumstance leading to his pardon by Gerry Ford. There's always been, I think, a reticence on the part of Congress to impose criminal penalties on a president, potentially leading to that constitutional issue coming up.
Right. I generally agree with you. I've looked at this question, and I think it's not a formal rule, but I think as a matter of practical concern, a sitting president can't be indicted. Maybe there would be an exception if there were some kind of imminent crisis, like if there were a president serial killer or something like that. But
right.
That's not. But in this case, I agree that Mueller would not be able to indict Trump until he were out of office. He could depose him. He could issue a subpoena. But I think it was correct during Watergate as well that Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator.
Right.
And then we wait until someone's out of office, because the risk is that a rogue prosecutor, you know, some federal prosecutor,
right,
could, with the support of one district judge, could issue a warrant for the arrest and imprisonment of a president, and that rogue judge would, you know, not issue any bond, and then you'd have the sitting president literally sitting in prison, and that would be a crisis in itself. So yeah, I agree.
Perhaps you'd have a pitched gunfight between federal marshals and the Secret Service.
Exactly.
So people are trying to avoid that kind of confrontation. Okay, and so maybe that accounts for why there are no criminal statutes that specifically prohibit this sort of behavior, but lots of ethical norms and lots of other ethical rules that perhaps are violated. Okay, so let's just sum up. We're running a little short on time here. Your position then is that this president has violated the Emoluments Clause, and he is therefore, what should be the remedy again?
Well, the first step here is simply discovery. I mean, the remedy at this stage is just information. The president is not sharing with Congress what money is coming in. So discovery is simply the step of trying to understand what money has come in from foreign sources. And then the next step is simply, my understanding, the lawyers who are working on the cases simply want the president to separate out that money and return it, not to accept that money at all. And so that this is not a criminal case. It's simply the pursuit of a civil injunction that will make sure that this clause is enforced. And so I didn't answer this part of your question before, but the concerns that come up are with the Trump Hotel in D.C., that it gets a lot of business from foreign sources. And there are stories about how people in the Trump administration have called up officials from places like Kuwait and said, "We see that you're scheduling an event and at another hotel. Would be great if you could cancel that event and move it over to the Trump Hotel." And that was a story that was reported back a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if those stories are, we don't know if those stories are true or not. The problem is that there's even an appearance or a question about whether those stories are true. This is not just about the strict events that are happening. It's about the appearance of bias, which undermines the credibility of an administration. So this is what the purposes of the clause these were the purposes of the clause, to make sure that there wasn't corruption or the appearance of corruption.
Right. And indeed, although that seems to be a very high bar, that concept, the appearance of impropriety and the avoidance of it, runs through all of professional ethics, or at least certainly all through legal ethics. Every law student learns that in his professional responsibility or her professional responsibility course in law school, that you want to be, what's the old phrase? You want to be like Caesar's wife. You want to be above suspicion. I think that's, you know, that's certainly the ideal, that you act with such rectitude that everybody has great confidence in you, that you're not acting, you're not self-dealing or double-dealing or doing anything else unethical. Okay, so you're looking for discovery, you're looking for divestment, or at least disgorgement, I should say, of any profits that have come.
That's right. Not divestment of the entire organization, but a sequestering. I think the word that the plaintiffs have used is sequestering the money to separate it out and to return it, but while letting the Trump Organization continue to serve as in its basic business model.
Well, we'll be watching all three of these cases and any others that might get filed in the near future with great interest. But in the meantime, Jed Sugarman of Fordham University, thank you so very much for explaining all this to us.
Well, great. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Studying the Constitution is always fun when really irrelevant parts become relevant. And with the election of Donald Trump going into the White House, we have a very dull part of the Constitution springing back to life, and that would be the Emolument Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emolument Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause of the Constitution.
Emoluments. President Trump is facing allegations that his businesses violate a provision in the Constitution known as the Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
Emoluments magnet.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
It violates the Emoluments Clause.
Emolument basically means any salary, earnings, or profit that come from one's job. It comes from Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 of the Constitution, and is sometimes referred to as the title of nobility clause.
The Emoluments Clause. The Constitution.
Emoluments.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
The Emoluments Clause.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. We're talking about the Emoluments Clauses today, and we've just heard from Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School. After the break, we'll hear from the other side. We'll hear from a guy named Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Stick around. And now let's continue our conversation about whether our current president is violating something called the Emoluments Clauses of the Constitution. Before the break, we heard from Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, who thinks the president is violating those clauses. And now we'll hear from Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law in Houston, who thinks precisely the opposite.
The Constitution has a provision which provides that no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. This is a provision of the Constitution that most people never even heard of until November of 2016. But it's a provision that has been studied very carefully by Seth Barrett Tillman. Seth is a professor at a law school in Ireland. I have known Seth for years, and I've got the a distinct honor of representing Seth as amicus curiae, a friend of the court brief, in several of the recently filed amicus clause litigations.
I think you meant to say emoluments clause litigation.
I'm sorry.
Okay, that's all right.
Too many words. The emoluments clause litigation.
Perfectly all right. And you filed amicus briefs, and as you say, that's a friend of a court brief. Could you explain what that is for people who are not familiar with what an amicus brief is?
Well, generally, in any given litigation, you have the plaintiff and you have the defendant. The plaintiff is a person who filed the lawsuit, and the defendant is a person who got sued. But courts also sometimes allow outside parties to express opinions that are not in the briefings. These are called amicus, like amigo, right? Friend of the court. And they can supplement the record with other positions. Seth and I have filed several briefs in a couple different courts in Maryland, in New York City, in the District of Columbia. And we've made a separate argument that the Trump administration is not making. To summarize, plaintiffs...
Oh, no, before we get there, no, you've explained that, but let's go back to the beginning and then we'll get to your actual arguments. So the Emoluments Clause prevents somebody from accepting something. And the plaintiffs in these cases have said that it prevents the president from accepting some kind of benefit that flows through his businesses to him personally. Is that a fair summary of what the plaintiffs are generally arguing?
Absolutely. So almost immediately after President Trump took the oath of office, within I think a day or so, lawsuits were filed in New York City alleging that Trump's business connections with foreign governments is unconstitutional. And the reason why is that these constitute emoluments. This is a weird word. We don't use it much today. But the plaintiffs in this case understand the word emoluments to mean things of value, business transactions. So because President Trump is profiting from his businesses, which deal with foreign governments, he's breaking the Constitution. For example, if a diplomat purchases a room at the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., that's Trump indirectly or directly perhaps profiting from that transaction. And that these plaintiffs have alleged that such transactions are not only bad policy, but are also unconstitutional.
And let's separate those for a moment. The policy argument is simply that most presidents have divested themselves of their business interests or put them into a so-called blind trust while they are in office, so that there will be greater trust that they by the public, that they are not acting in their own behalf as they make their executive decisions. This president has decidedly taken a different course of action. And as a matter of policy, one can be concerned about this or not concerned about it as one chooses. That's the policy issue. But the constitutional issue is specifically whether Mr. Trump's decision to not do that, to keep his businesses and to arguably, in some sense, even promote them from time to time, at least by making references to them, that that would violate this Emoluments Clause. And your position is that it doesn't, right?
Right. Well, the position we argue is a little bit different. We do make arguments concerning what an emolument is.
Okay.
Those aren't too original, so I'll do that first.
Okay.
Traditionally, an emolument referred to something profitable that relates from a business relationship, mm-hmm. right? So if I hire you to mow my lawn or to fix my roof or something, and I pay you, that salary is an emolument. And we argue that this is traditionally how the word emolument was understood, that it didn't refer to incidental benefits from business relationships like owning stock and giving, getting returns on investments. It had to do with a specific fiduciary relationship. That is, Russia couldn't hire Donald Trump as a contractor to engage in certain services. That very well could be an emolument. But what we're talking about here is not an emolument.
Okay, and the purpose for such a ban is generally understood to be that we don't want foreign governments buying influence with people who hold an office of trust in the United States.
Exactly, yeah. So we don't think that the provision applies to the president, but even if it did, the sorts of transactions that are at issue, someone staying at a hotel, if some diplomat buys a martini at Trump's bar, right? That's not what an emolument is.
And let's go a little bit more into that, and you know more about this than I do. I've never researched it, but my understanding has been that this clause may have resulted from a concern that about things that the British king had done for many years and basically had given sinecures or no-work jobs to various members of parliament and thereby bought influence. Is that a correct historical reading?
Right. There was a serious concern about certain officials being put under a foreign control. When you're under someone's financial control, you do what they say. What's the expression? He who pays the piper calls the tune.
Yes. He who has the gold rules.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. So the form of the Foreign Emoluments Clause we have in our Constitution actually descends from the Articles of Confederation, that is the government that preceded our Constitution. Mm-hmm. And there was a similar provision in that document. So this didn't come up out of nowhere. in 1787. This was a fear that was floating around for some time.
Okay, and it's your position that not only is Trump's business interests not constitute an emolument, but that the clause itself doesn't even apply to him.
Well, not just that, it doesn't apply to elected officials, and allow me to explain. This phrase, all persons holding office under the United States, this is a phrase used in various parts of the Constitution. And when I say office under the United States to you, you think, well, what does that mean? Someone who gets a federal paycheck? But at the time of the framing, this phrase office under had a significance. It was a term of art. And it concerned people who were appointed to office and not elected to office. And you can read our brief. I can bore you with it for hours. but there's a lot of evidence going back to British parliamentary practice. Even to this day in Commonwealth countries, when you say office under the crown, it means someone who's appointed to an office, the sinecure you mentioned, and not an elected official. If this is right, and we think it is, it wouldn't. This clause would not apply to the president. It would not apply to members of Congress. These are positions that are directly accountable to the people, and if the people don't like them, they can be removed. Appointed people, however, can't be subject to electoral validation, and so that is the sort of people who are at issue. So the Secretary of State, for example, would not be allowed to accept foreign emoluments. The clerk of the House of Representatives, right, would not be allowed to accept foreign emoluments, but the president and members of Congress could. Now, if Congress wants to add additional rules, they can. They can always regulate their own members above and beyond the Constitution. But what can't be done is to add new constraints in the presidency. That is a no-no. And that's what the plaintiffs in this case are asking the courts to do.
That's very interesting. So just based upon this being a term of art and based upon your historical research, it does not apply to elected officials. Well, that's a little inconsistent with my understanding of it because, of course, I'm not questioning your research, but I'm simply saying that members of parliament are elected officials. And if the concern dated back to the king buying members of parliament, then one would think that it would apply to elected officials in the United States, too.
The British practice is a little bit tricky about transporting it over. And I think we have to look to American practice as well of how the early republic functioned. You have examples of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe. These are four of our first five founding presidents. Mm-hmm. And they all accepted gifts from foreign governments. There's no evidence they ever asked for congressional consent. There's no evidence they ever kept it. Had Congress wanted to draft the Foreign Emoluments Clause to embrace elected officials as well, they could have used other language. There are parts of the Constitution that uses language to reach all species of federal officers at both the elected and appointed level.
Okay, what's that language?
So the broadest language in the Constitution is what's actually in the Religious Test Clause. Mm-hmm. This is a provision of the Constitution that prohibits religious tests. And this applies to all people holding trust under the United States. Hold on, let me get the exact phrasing. I don't want to...
It's Article 6, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I want to make sure I want to read the exact phrasing, right? So
You and I have exactly the same approach. Whenever I find myself paraphrasing the Constitution and there's a copy around, I will stop and read the actual words. It's a good idea.
Yeah. So it says, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And this phrase public trust reaches everything, elected, appointed, alike. That is the widest range, the umbrella, if you will, public trust. This phrase office under the United States, though, in a few different contexts is used, and it does not reach elected positions. So if you take the position that the framers understood this parliamentary drafting practice, which I do, and they used it in several different locations, then you have to go with what the text means. And it leads to the conclusion that these elected positions are not subject to these aspects of the Constitution.
So if we don't like what the president's doing with regard to his business interests, we vote him out at the next election, and that's the remedy.
Of course you can, yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. That's not your only argument, though, is it?
What else do we argue?
Recently your side won in the New York case, I believe it was.
The Southern District of New York dismissed the case on standing grounds.
Okay,
so we don't really address the standing arguments, but we do address some related issues. But no court has had to confront this issue. There'll be oral argument in the District of Maryland on January, I think, 26th. The court there is also only interested in standing. So it doesn't look like any species of our argument will come up in the foreseeable future. But if a court does find that their standing to proceed in the case is justiciable, at that point, this argument will have to be addressed one way or the other.
You mentioned a couple of concepts there. Standing is always a disappointing basis for a case to be dismissed if you're interested in the ultimate issue. The idea there is that you have to have a specific plaintiff with a specific particularized injury. And whenever the president or some other national officer does something you don't like, it's very difficult to say my injury is specific rather than the same injury that arguably all Americans suffer. And so if you're trying to speak on behalf of all Americans, the court will say, no, we don't have generalized standing of that sort. But I did notice the New York court also did say something else that you just mentioned. They said it was a non-justiciable political question. And that does get close to what you were talking about, because essentially what the court is saying is that this is not the sort of thing courts decide. This is the sort of thing that Congress, which is given the power, of course, to consent to these sorts of emoluments, that Congress should decide. It's something for the political part of government to decide rather than the judiciary. Was that satisfying to you?
Well, yes and no. Under our position, the president's not subject to the clause in the first place, so there's nothing to consent to.
Mm-hmm.
But assuming we're wrong, the fact that the clause specifically references Congress and that Congress is the branch to consent should give the courts pause before they intercede. This concept of a political question is somewhat unfamiliar to non-lawyers. It's not a hard and fast fixed rule. That is, it's not a situation where the courts are prohibited from proceeding. But if a court determines that this is a question that's better left the other branches, there's reason to perhaps pull back and not address the issue directly. I don't have a clear-cut answer on the political question doctrine, because it's a very muddy, murky doctrine.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of reasons why courts should hesitate before ruling on this case on prudential grounds.
Yeah, it's a very poorly named doctrine, because I have to repeatedly tell my students every year, this does not mean that courts will avoid politically charged issues. I mean, courts rule on things like abortion every day. In some sense, it's a misleading name. It actually proceeds from the concept the courts have that they are an apolitical branch. Their job is not political, whereas the president and the Congress are political. These are people who are elected to carry out certain policies that they've promised to carry out, and that there are certain disputes and certain issues that should be left to those type of branches and not decided by judges sitting in their black robes. So that, again, in some sense, as you say, if they do reject your original contention that the president's not subject to this, then that could be a fallback for you all. In fact, this judge's opinion up in New York seems to have pretty much hit everything that would please your side. In fact, didn't he actually get to some of the substance of this and express grave doubts that there would be an emoluments clause issue?
Well, I don't see this as my side versus their side. We filed a brief in support of the government, but in some senses we're a bit in tension with the government, because they're not advancing our position.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is that the court in New York definitely touched every base. I don't know if it's impenetrable. I think there might be some chinks in the armor, so to speak. There might be some errors in the reasoning. But as a bottom line matter, to the extent that this clause does apply to the president, it should be for Congress and Congress alone to resolve this issue.
Understood. Okay. Well, what's the, you mentioned there's a case down in Maryland, and that's going to be argued soon. What's the other pending case?
So there are three cases. There was the one in Manhattan, the Southern District of New York. In that case, the government's already prevailed. The second case will have almost 6 or 7 hours of argument time on January 25th or 26th in the District of Maryland in Greenbelt. And the third case is filed in the District of Columbia. There's no oral argument scheduled there. I think the judge might resolve this one on the papers, just on the briefs. And that case was brought by 200-some-odd members of Congress who are challenging this.
That's interesting.
Well, it's bizarre because if Congress really wanted to do something about it, they would take a vote. But, of course, the Democratic members can't because they don't have a majority yet. They may have it in about a year or so, in which case I'm sure this will be their first order of business. But this is not a well-considered case that I think will be dismissed very quickly. The D.C. Circuit has a lot of case law on whether members of Congress can sue, and I don't think this one clears the hurdle.
What is the hurdle, generally speaking, for members of Congress to sue rather than to act through a vote?
Well, there's no Supreme Court case allowing it. In the 1990s, there was a decision where involving the Line Item Veto Act, and a couple of members of Congress brought suit saying that the Line Item Veto was unconstitutional. And the court said that individual members can't bring a lawsuit. We also know that the House of Representatives sued to challenge a provision of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And the district court actually permitted standing there, but that case never made it up to the Supreme Court and probably never will. So we don't have a clear resolution whether an entire House of Congress could. But this lawsuit I mentioned in D.C. falls closer to the Line Item Veto case because you have individual members bringing the suit. I don't see this one going anywhere.
Yeah, I've always thought that was sort of odd, especially that last circumstance you mentioned, because I don't see how a member of Congress has any more interest in the outcome of this than Joe Citizen does. Now, you can make arguments in certain circumstances that, you know, there's an institutional interest. I mean, if the entire House of Representatives, as you say in the other case, files a lawsuit and can point to some aspect of the Constitution where it is being prejudiced by the executive action, for example. Okay, I think that's probably closer to having some sort of specific standing. But yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think the 200 members of Congress will probably be disappointed.
Oh, I don't think they'll be disappointed. They knew this was a loser. they do this for political purposes, and it served that purpose quite well.
Understood. Well, Josh, this has all been very enlightening. Any further thoughts before we finish?
No, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate you. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to both of our guests today, Jed Sugarman of Fordham Law School, and of course, Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law at Houston, whom we just heard from. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. Our distribution engineer, of course, is Chad Barrett. And my name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.